Good morning, everyone. This is Shirley Draper, co-host of the Sunstone Firesides podcast. Today, I am with a practicing polygamist because, as you know, I have one song, and that is All Things Polygamy. I do a lot of social work with the population, and lately I've just become very cognizant of the harms that happen, the real human costs that result as a way of the way we treat this population. And so today, I have with me Vicky Darger, who is a practicing polygamist, and we are going to talk with her about her life and her family and kind of some of the things about the way we grew up in a polygamist family. And then we're going to get into discussing the laws and the impacts. So good morning, Vicky.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How are you today?
Good. Happy to be here.
Okay. So we're just going to launch right in. Talk to me a little bit about what it was like being raised in a polygamist family.
Well, for the most part, I had just a really great childhood. My mom had 16 children, my dad had three wives, and we lived near each other, not in the same home, but near each other. And I just had built-in friends and playmates. And because we were just in a typical suburban neighborhood, it wasn't the easiest as far as that went. But inside the home was a safe and wonderful place. Outside the home, it was a little more scary. There were a lot of prejudices. It was a mostly Mormon neighborhood, which isn't a bad thing. There are a lot of things that we could identify with our neighbors, but they also did not agree with polygamy, and some of them were kind of harsh and didn't treat us very well because of that. Oftentimes, we made friends with people who were more of minorities and things like that. But overall, as far as family life, wonderful. Outside the family, a little scary.
So talk to me about that scary stuff, and how did that impact things like educational decisions and social decisions that you would make?
Well, we went to public school, and you know, we lived in fear of the word polygamy ever being brought up, just because you didn't want to get looked at as different. Everyone wants to fit in the schools and have friends. And so it was, and it did get brought up sometimes. So you felt like, you know, your head was burning and all eyes were looking at you and everyone was going to hate you once they found out, or if it was talked about. Going to public school, there were, you know, we just hoped to find some friends that either didn't care or just wouldn't find out.
So did that impact things like deciding to join clubs and other educational extracurricular activities?
Well, I'm sure that it did, as far as especially where our parents were concerned, especially now being a parent, I can see even a lot more of that. We kind of kept to ourselves, and that worked in a lot of ways, and there were a lot of ways where it didn't work. We didn't feel like that we could be included in most of society and the way that things were done. And so, yeah, I think we did miss out on a lot of extracurricular activities and just being a part of other, you know, just outside interests that could have enriched our lives a lot.
So that's going to play into something that I'm going to bring up later about the cost, the opportunity costs that happen to people from fundamentalist organizations when
Yes.
they're not allowed to network, they're not allowed to access those clubs where they will be introduced to other people and might further their career. So there's a real economic impact to that fear as well.
Absolutely. I think there's a lot that we have a lot to offer, and we have a lot that we could gain from other people, and we're not allowed any of that.
So you mentioned that it impacted your mom, you know, when you would go out and try to be part of things. Tell me what would happen with your mom.
Well, my mom was a great lady, and she had a lot of fears, though, too. She was actually 10 years old at the time of the infamous raid on Short Creek in 1953. A little girl scared, and she's told us the story many times, and how the police officers were just scary, and they came in with loud sirens and guns and things like that and took away their families. They just ripped apart these families. And she was taken with her mother and other siblings, and they were taken to Phoenix and put in a rest home, and they didn't see their family for 2 years. They had no cell phones. She didn't have a car. It was really abuse, I think. It was like a kidnapping and abuse by the state. So she lived with that fear her whole life.
And so her fear for you was that you would be taken from her.
Our family, now that I'm married, have been very public because we've seen a lot of these harms. And each and every time we do an interview and she would see it there, I think it was a big conflict for her because on one hand, she was very proud and excited about the possibilities, but on the other hand, very frightened about what kind of things it could open up for not only our family, but all of our extended families and everyone we knew who lived the same way that we did.
And I will say, you know, growing up polygamist, my father was also a child during the 1953 raid, and it was drilled into me that we do not talk to law enforcement. We do not trust government. When I was a child, we lived in abject poverty, but we did not apply for food stamps and government assistance in any way because that would open up our family to scrutiny, and there was no way that we were going to invite the government into our home. And that really drilled in me the importance of not ever reporting anything to law enforcement because of that fear. You know, I did not have a day go by, even in my public education, where I didn't hear about what the government was capable of, fearful for my family, and that really informed my childhood. And I'm sure that it was the same for you.
Well, absolutely was. I mean, all my grandfathers spent time in the Utah State Penitentiary for polygamy. They were ripped from their families for up to 7 years. And, you know, those stories are passed down. And my dad, at a pretty young age, had to take on being the man of the family and helping to support that family because of what the big bad government did. And so those are the stories that are passed down to us. And then as we go forward and we look at what the laws that are on the books, and it hangs over our head, and we are felt like we cannot speak about who we are. We can't say who we are. We have to keep it a secret. And there is a very real fear. And it's even if it's just unknown, we don't know what could happen. Could there be another raid? Could my children get taken away? Any of those kinds of things.
And there have been raids recently, right? I mean, in 2008 in Texas, in 2015 in Short Creek. And from my perspective, it's not that something didn't need to happen there. It's just that the fact that there was a raid really sent shockwaves around all the fundamentalist populations, as far as I was able to tell. And so because of that chilling effect on your voice, it's like you're not a citizen. It's like you do not get to participate in our democracy. You don't get to speak. You don't get to, you know, have representation in the government because you are a second-class citizen and you are not allowed to come out in public and be who you are.
Absolutely. Just the word raid. I mean, if you think that you are from a community that, you know, could be raided, that's a terrible word. And as a child who grows up with that, the sound of that word, it just sounds scary and awful. And you do want to keep your head down. You want to just move straight forward. And I think by and large, at least the people who I grew up with, most of the people that I know are law-abiding citizens. This is just something that they believe in deeply. Or, you know, even if they have been taught and have made that choice, it doesn't always work out. But I think sometimes the law actually is the cause of sometimes it not working out. Not like it's to blame because there's always people and relationships, but it doesn't help because there are services and things that we can't have access to like most other citizens do.
Right. And so I think it's really interesting. Right now, there's a lot of study and emphasis on epigenetics and the impacts of generational trauma on people and how it shows up in DNA, you know, particularly with survivors of the Holocaust and their offspring. And I think that this would be a population that would be really interesting to study because I want to point out that plural marriage, to use the term that fundamentalists use, has been practiced for 180 years. You know, some of these families trace their lineage back to the beginning of this. And so to assume that it hasn't impacted our DNA, that it's not in our blood and it doesn't inform because of all of the long-term trauma, you know, talking about Governor Boggs' extermination order in what was it, 1838, that you could be fired on and killed for living your religion, that doesn't inform our DNA. And it doesn't inform how our children operate in this world and whether or not they have access to opportunities and whether or not, honestly, they become full functioning citizens and tax paying citizens and contribute to the economics of the state. And so, you know, I really kind of want to get into that a little bit later. But right now I want to say, so despite all of that, despite the fear that you grew up with, you still chose to enter a polygamous marriage. Tell me why and some of the outcomes of that.
I know I consider myself a pretty smart and person that thinks through their decisions, and I'm just one of those weird people, but I because I've had a very good example set for me. My father was very loving. My mothers didn't get along all the time, but there was love present, and we knew that we were cared for and looked out for, and that we had a lot of people that had our back. And so that to me was just a very comforting and comfortable way, and I always wanted to live that way, and I always wanted many children. And so I definitely made that choice consciously. It wasn't that I didn't go out and investigate other things, but I did already have it in my mind. Now, some people would say that's grooming and that's brainwashing, and I guess it could be considered that, but I don't see how it would be any different than any other religious belief or non-religious belief, quite honestly.
Right. I mean, we're all products of our environment. And so I was actually going to bring that up. You know, a lot of people who are against polygamy will say you did not have a choice, even though you were an adult when you made this decision. They want to impose on you maybe lower cognition, or that you were brainwashed and so you weren't able to make this choice. And so I'm really happy you brought that up, that I don't know that we can really single out one population and say your lifestyle is abuse because you tell your children that this is what God wants. I mean, I think I can name more than 1,000 religions that do that. And I believe that that's a legal activity for religions, you know, to say this is how God wants you to live. I don't know any religion that doesn't do that. But tell me, when you were a child, did your father tell you, if you don't become a polygamist, you're going to go to hell?
I had never heard those words from my father or my mother's mouth. As I grew up, I heard that other families and people did say those things. I never heard anyone actually say it, but I don't doubt that it actually did happen. So for me, when people like to broad brush polygamous families or people who live this way or believe this way and say they all do this and they all do that, I get to say, actually, not all of them do. And I get to say that I come from a family who didn't do that. And I, as a mother, and my husband as a father, has not done that to our children. I think my dad is the person who I've never seen a person him other than him who believes in free agency and practices it with his children. It is you make your choices and you will have the consequences and rewards of those choices. And he is supportive of that. I think a lot of people would be surprised to know just in my family. In fact, they are surprised. I tell people, I'm like, yes, I have a sister-in-law who is a Buddhist and she's fully accepted and loved. And I have people of other differing beliefs as in-laws and as nieces and nephews. And they're all welcomed at family gatherings and nobody is shunned for how they believe. And some things, you know, it might take us a minute and we have to think about that and go, okay, I don't know how I feel about this. But we always come around because there's always an underlying sense of love and connection.
Right. And I will say that, you know, even growing up FLDS, which is much stricter than the way you were raised, I was never told directly, if you don't live polygamy, you will go to hell. I was taught God wants you to live this religion. And this religion comprised so much more than polygamy. Polygamy is just one tenet, and it's not the one that's talked about the most. You know, there are all of these Mormon texts that we adhere to deeply. And so, you know, it's not like there's this polygamous drill and that the marriage is the be-all end-all. There's so much more to it, and it's so much more layered and complex than it's given credit for. And so, to me, the religion, it was just a piece of it. There were so many more requirements, you know, morality and those things that were required of me growing up that the majority of my time and focus was spent on. And so, you know, I think it's really easy to demonize a single practice of a religion. But I think unless you take the entire thing in its complexity and in context, that it's going to create issues. We have to address that it is a deeply held, sincerely held religious belief.
Yeah, I really agree with you on that. I think it's so interesting that we can, you know, the people say they're a polygamist as though it's a religion. Oh, they're either a Mormon or a Christian or a Catholic or a polygamist. Well, no, it really isn't like that. And it is just one tenet. And what I like to consider myself is an independent fundamentalist Mormon. I think that wraps it up and kind of says it all.
And the truth of the matter is there are so many different family forms within this religion. And I've been really impressed with your family structure. I have never seen a more egalitarian family. And I'm talking about in monogamy and everything.
That's a big statement.
Well, I mean, I'm not really a fan of any kind of marital structure. But I think that, you know, consenting adults should be allowed to configure their families the way they want to. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. that. I think, you know, there is abuse in monogamy. And people don't say, well, you know, it's marriage that causes domestic violence. There's this false equivalence that polygamy is abuse. And there are so many different structures. From my perspective, I believe that any patriarchal arrangement sets up the capacity for someone to be abused, but it isn't necessarily going to happen, right? And so even monogamy, there's domestic violence in monogamy, but no one has ever looked at that and said, oh, well, that was caused by marriage. And, you know, we know that their incest only happens within the structure of a family. And no one has ever looked at that and said, oh, well, it's the family structure that causes incest. We need to do away with the family structure. And so I kind of want to talk
kind
about
of how ridiculous it is, right? I mean, when you say it like that, it does sound ridiculous, but that is exactly what is happening.
It really is. And so when detractors are saying, well, there's abuse in polygamy and there is fraud in polygamy and there's all of these problems in polygamy, we have laws that address those. And it doesn't matter who commits that crime, it should be prosecuted. If there's underage marriage, if there is sexual abuse, it should be prosecuted no matter where it happens. And it's really interesting to me that, you know, we have huge incidents in the Catholic religion where Catholic priests have committed sexual assault, but nobody is saying that Catholicism causes sexual assault. But that equivalence happens over and over and over with polygamy. And I do believe that it is an outcropping of the law against polygamy and how it's really codified to be, it's legal to discriminate against this population. And so I kind of want to get into that. But before I do, I want to go back and talk about, you know, we talked about the kind of fear that you lived in as a child and the impacts it had on your choices and on your family. But I want to talk some also about the impacts it's had on your children and your family right now. Tell me some of the things that's happened as a result of, you know, having to live quietly and undercover.
As a young woman and making that decision to get married, I didn't get to have, you know, the big fantasy wedding. Didn't get to share that with the world, really. It was a very private affair. And, you know, that's a choice that I made. At the same time, that would have been great to go celebrate with a bunch of people and announce that. Didn't get to do that. For a while there, we did do homeschool. And that was not necessarily out of fear. It was just something that we wanted to do. We loved spending time with our children and thought that would be a great thing to be able to teach them. And we, you know, there was actually a huge homeschool convention in the state of Utah, not only by polygamous people, but sometimes it's pointed at as though it's some extreme thing that extremists do. And it's really not. There are really a lot of people that do that. But then making the decision to put our kids in public school was kind of a scary thing. And about 18 years ago, my sister wife had a child that passed away due to some birth defect complications. And she was 5 months old at the time. And this was a big shock to our entire family. And it was also, unfortunately, it turned out to be a very fearful time. We never really got time to grieve that child who we loved so dearly because guess what? We were being investigated by the state because of our last name. Because there are common names that the state keeps track of, you know, according to story. And they were just able to do that as though it was just okay to go on a little bit of a witch hunt and see what else they could find out about our family to maybe prosecute and, you know, possibly take the children away. And that was a very scary time for about a year and a half. And after going through that, you know, part of us wanted to just even go deeper into the whatever shadows we could find and just hide. But part of us was like, we cannot put up with this any longer. We can't live this way. It's actually abusive. It's unhealthy, and good things cannot come from that. And so we decided to start speaking out, which turned out to be one of the best decisions we could have made. As we did that, a lot of other plural families were also very visibly shaken and scared for us and for themselves. They thought, well, if we say our name on TV, then it's going to implicate them because they have the same name and everyone's going to be looking at them as well. And we caused a lot of controversy. So for a time there, we felt like we really didn't have a place. It was just our family. We didn't fit in with the outside world and we no longer fit in with the inside society that we were raised in and grew up with and lived with. So it was kind of a difficult time for our family. At the time, our children couldn't speak about who they were at the schools. They went to the same schools and, you know, they would say that they were cousins because what else are you going to say? Even though they were siblings, they had different moms. So, you know, you have to lie and you don't feel good about it. That's because we just wanted to be who we were. I want to say, no, that's my sister. You know, I have three moms. And so it really caused a lot of inner turmoil and conflict and things like that. I want to bring up one particular time where at the time some of this was going on, my parents had a vandal come and spray paint on their driveway some obscene language, and it included polygamy, but it was very obscene. And My dad cleaned it up himself and would not call the cops. He wouldn't report it. He said, we'll just take care of it ourselves. There's no need to get law enforcement involved. And that's the typical way that a lot of things are dealt with. We don't believe we can have access to the services, as Shirley said before, even where when they are needed for our own protection, because the fear of what it could, of the harm that it could do us is greater than whatever we think the protection could be.
You know, that struck me while you were talking about that, you know, being investigated, your life being investigated when you've suffered this horrible trauma in your life. And that theme has come up over and over, this double jeopardy that binds people in from fundamentalist organizations, that, you know, they're on the hook for taking care of their children and for getting what their children need. But if they're in poverty and they access SNAP benefits, then they're criminals for accessing SNAP benefits, but they would also be criminals for not taking care of their children. Or that, you know, they need to get medical services for their children. But if they go in and they're deviants because of their lifestyle, then it opens them up to all of this other harm. And so this double bind that you have to examine every single movement that you make and weigh the costs and the benefits. You know, is it, do we really need more nutrition at the expense of our privacy? Do we really want public education at the fear of having people come in on us? And so I lived that way. We did not access SNAP when I was a child, and we needed it. You know, I think that there are so many privileges that are denied this population. I tell the story of my mom, you know, when she was kicked out of the FLDS community by Warren Jeffs and moved to St. George, and she was finally deciding to settle in St. George and make it her home. And she went to the driver's license division, and they were horrible to her because of what she looked like. And at the time, she wasn't even in any marriage, let alone a polygamous marriage, but because she appeared to be, the driver's license clerk denied her a driver's license. And I mean, I think those are the kinds of things that people don't realize, that this law, you know, the law against someone's deeply held religious belief has these long-term ripple impacts where street-level bureaucrats and people in Walmart are justified because discrimination and stigma is codified. The message they receive is that not only is it okay to discriminate against this population and make assumptions about them, but you should.
Hi, I'm Stephen Carter. Since 1975, Sunstone Magazine has been publishing the best of Mormon thought and experience. And now, Sunstone is also a podcast, where you can listen to audible quality recordings of our best articles, essays, stories, and poetry, both new and classic. Come get a taste with our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone. We look forward to being a part of your journey.
So I kind of want to get into the law. Let's talk about the law.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all the things that you just brought up so many emotions for me, because I do want to get into the law. But another thing that happened in our family is we had a daughter who, we had just gone out on an anniversary date, actually. So all the parents had left the home and we had babysitters at home, and had a tragic accident. We got a phone call that my baby at the time, who was 8 months old, had an accident, and they were taking her to the hospital, and it didn't look good. And she had something fall on her. And of course, you know, the worst fear imaginable as a mother. And along with that, I had to go, oh no, you know, what are they going to say? It's, you know, they're going to go into this home. First of all, the parent wasn't home. And, you know, I just could imagine all the things that could happen. And then you have an expensive life flight ride. And, you know, and we didn't have, you know, great health coverage at the time. So they wanted us to get on Medicaid. And we said, no, we'd really like to take care of this. What can we do? And there really wasn't anything they would let us do. Well, I wasn't the legal wife, so I had to fill out the paperwork. How do I fill that out? I didn't even know how to fill it out. Like, I had to, it's just so hard to go through all those things. And then what, I'm a fraud if I fill it out with what is legally true, because what is legally true is I'm a single mother. So how else can that be stated? And I just want to just bring up how horrifying that is, and dealing with that your baby almost dies and you have to think about all of these things and how you're going to protect yourself. And it's just such a great, great fear. And I remember listening to the radio, a radio program, and I think it was Glenn Beck at the time, and he was talking about this issue of the polygamists. And he was saying, you know, people say it like, oh, they're otherwise law-abiding citizens. It's just that they just break this one law. And he said, how ridiculous is that? I mean, well, that could be the same could be said of a serial killer. They are basically law-abiding citizens, but there's just this one law. And I just thought, wow, that really, people can really look at it that way. And to me, you know, we aren't harming anyone. And if we are, then we should be gone after. But we aren't harming anyone. And we shouldn't have that extra enhancement that makes even the existing laws even harsher because I happen to, you know, have an illegal marriage with someone.
And so what you're referring to is that additional penalty. We're going to talk about House Bill 99 that is now the law in the state of Utah. But first, we're going to kind of set this up. Let's talk about the definition of polygamy and bigamy. And let's talk about how they're different. So bigamy is obtaining two marriage licenses with two different people who don't know about each other with the intent to defraud. How is that different from polygamy?
Yeah, if my husband had done that to me and married someone else without my knowledge, then I would want him prosecuted too, for sure. So polygamy is the difference in that is in my case, and I think many other people's cases, is it's not an attempt to defraud. It's not even a legal marriage. Usually, typically, one wife has a legal marriage and the others are just a spiritual or a spoken commitment to one another. And all parties involved are consenting adults and they make that choice and decision together, and in my case particularly, create a family together.
So there's only one marriage license obtained. There are not more than one marriage license. And so in order to investigate and to prosecute, then we have to make different accommodations for polygamy than we do for bigamy. So this brings up how the law is written. So in the state of Utah, up until 2 years ago, polygamy, which it's called bigamy amendments, But we're going to just talk about the law against polygamy now, because that's really what it is. It just read that, you know, if a man cohabits or purports to marry, then it's a misdemeanor. And 2 years ago, the state legislature narrowly passed House Bill 99 that changed the language to say a man or woman who cohabits and purports to marry, because frankly, cohabiting is done by many, many people, and they really don't want to do anything about that. They really want to target this unpopular minority, this socially constructed deviant population.
So-called deviant.
So we're going to talk about that too, about how, you know, social construction of target populations. Mm-hmm. But so right now, so they changed the language to say a man or woman who cohabits and purports to marry. So now it's not just the men who are on the hook. Mm-hmm. It's also women. So in the instance where you were in the hospital with your baby and they come in and they investigate and find out that you purported to marry someone who already had a wife, you could have had your daughter taken away and then been charged with, get this, it's now a felony. So there's an enhanced penalty now, which I just want to point out how kind of insane and disproportionate that law is.
Wow. In the state, I don't even know what to say about that one.
In the state of Utah, you can still beat your wife to a bloody pulp and it's just a misdemeanor. But should you live your religion, should you follow through with a deeply held, sincere religious belief, you are a felon. I mean, let's just take a minute and think about that.
Yeah, let that sink in.
How hateful do we have to be to felonize people for their religion? This is so troubling. There are so many things about that. We're going to talk about how this law, as it's written, violates the First, the Fourth, and the 14th Amendments. So the First Amendment, of course, is the right to free speech. So we have criminalized purporting.
Because I say I'm a wife. There's no legal document. I just say that. Like, I consider myself that. That's illegal.
Okay.
To express.
Right. And then the Fourth Amendment, which gives you the right to privacy. I will point out that Lawrence v. Texas really kind of settled whether we get to prosecute people for cohabiting. You don't get to, period. That's the end of the story.
Right.
So purporting, free speech, cohabiting, privacy.
Privacy.
And then from my perspective, and I'm not a legal scholar, and maybe we can poll the audience here, but in my opinion, this law also violates the 14th Amendment, which guarantees equal protection under the law. Because what it says is that if someone who is doing this violates any other law, then all of those other laws, you know, should they commit petty theft or break the speed limit or whatever, that suddenly they're going to be charged with a felony. And that does not equally apply across. It's just if you happen to be in this religion and you commit that other crime, then they can enhance the penalty. And I think it's so interesting that this wasn't thought through very well. How can you apply laws differently to different classes of people?
It's an interesting thing because I think a lot of lawmakers really have their hearts in the right place. And I think because of the narrative and the things that have been in the news and the sensationalism of it all, that maybe they have bought into a lot of the stories about how we were all this way and polygamists are all that way, because otherwise I don't see how they can support that kind of a thing. You know, and we're always told, well, if you don't like the law, then you should change it. And well, we have really been working hard at changing it. And it is kind of a long battle. You know, when you have in the Utah state constitution and they tell, we've had several of them tell us, well, I took an oath that polygamy would forever be banned in the state of Utah. And this is like forever. And they can't even look at the fact that that's actually unconstitutional in itself against the United States Constitution.
Right.
It just blows my mind.
So, and that's probably a little bit intractable. I mean, changing a state constitution is nearly impossible. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to go there. But what I really want to talk about is when people buy into the narrative, you know, that all polygamists are abusive, all polygamists marry underage girls, all polygamists defraud the government and are welfare frauds. Let's talk about why those myths persist.
Well, I think a lot of, like I said, there is a little bit of a sensationalism to it, and there's a huge lack of education. And with that is, there's a huge lack of kind of wanting to know the truth for most people, because it's easy to believe, and maybe it's even a little fun to believe that there's some weirdos out there. But I think that because there's such a strong narrative, and because there have been cases that have been in the news and have been really strong arguments against polygamy, at the same time, I think there have been some cases, you know, I don't know all the ins and outs of it, but that maybe, you know, the verdict was reached too fast by the public, not saying like by the law, because it's so easy to just go, oh, he's a polygamist, must be bad. All that must be true. And I do the same thing. I'm human. I judge people based on narratives of things that I've grown up with, you know, kind of being fed. I watch TV. I've gone to public schools. So I hear the same things too. And I know there's a lot of underprivileged or underserved communities. So I think that's part of what happens is they're allowed to, because, well, they are breaking the law. So I am allowed to look down on that behavior and anything else they do that I don't like either, and just not understand that.
And I want to bring in from my experience, you know, when there are rumors and myths and speculation about a population that has been, you know, outlawed for existing, then, you know, somebody from that population does not have the privilege of speaking out and correcting the dominant discourse. And we do this with indigenous societies all the time, right? We gaze at them with this paternalistic gaze and we say, oh, they are doing this. That must mean this. And we get to define that population. We get to define what their rituals and customs and beliefs mean. We don't let them define it. And then when we decide that they are deviant because we don't understand or we don't agree with whatever they're doing, then they become very closed mouth. They don't say anything because now we're going to treat them poorly. And then, you know, they're going to go underground because they're in fear. And now we're going to pass laws against them. Mm-hmm. And so for them to come out and speak out and say, no, that's not true. No, that's not what that means. It puts their lives in jeopardy, just like we've talked about for this entire podcast. So, you know, it's the same thing that persisted, like that really pernicious rumor that there's a baby graveyard in Hilldale where they bury murdered babies. That has gone on and on and on in the media. There's nothing close to the truth about that, except for the fact that there's a baby graveyard. But nobody has gone out and corrected that discourse because we don't get to. Yeah. We don't get to define what our lives and our rituals and our customs are. And so, you know, that really brings up the social theories, you know, talking about Hogg's uncertainty identity principle, where people who enjoy low status are driven into into places because of their uncertainty about their life and their place in the world, they kind of band together and become more rigid, and they define rigidly their boundaries. And I saw this happen in the FLDS. I mean, we're going to talk a little bit about Warren Jeffs and what he did to fundamentalists through his crimes. But as a child, we were so uncertain about the outside world. And I lived in a community that we were all the same, but we banded together because of that, because of how low status we were and how we could count on being treated when we went to St. George, that, you know, we rigidly defined our boundaries so that we would feel certain about our place in the world. And when that persists, then low status groups tend to become really extreme and fundamentalist. And then there are a lot of those kinds of things that happen. And so, you know, in my opinion, Warren Jeffs is an outcropping of that. He knew that we were afraid of the government. He knew that we did not have anywhere else to be, and that our very sense of belonging, which is the number one human psychological need, and our definition of who we are, our very identity, was dependent on belonging to this group. And we were so afraid of the government because of that 1953 raid that we were never going to report. And so he started doing more and more and more extreme things. And he would never have risen to that power. He would never have had that control if that fear of the outside and our uncertainty of our place in the world hadn't been so ingrained. I honestly believe that Warren Jeffs is a natural outcome of the laws against our very existence.
I wholeheartedly agree. I think he played upon the fears of an otherwise good people, well-meaning people, people that did just want to kind of be left alone to live their beliefs and would have been happy to be part of society were they allowed to. It wasn't like everyone in that group was antisocial and, you know, extremists. It really allowed him to play upon the fears and push that group even further underground and to try to hide, you know, a lot of the atrocities. And I think that can happen. And it is a byproduct of the strict law and just the, just like I said before, of us not being able to say who we are. And in times when we really need to be able to say who we are and be treated equally and fairly and get some services that many people need access to. And it's not just services that only the polygamous people need, right? It's services that all people in all walks of life will need, whether it's counseling or welfare or police protection, whatever it is.
Right? I mean, and I think that this idea in our minds that has been confirmed for 180 years worth of contact with law enforcement, that we do not enjoy equal protection of our police force. You know, that kind of thing sets us up for someone who has some megalomania to rise up and exploit a population that lives in fear and is extremely vulnerable because we can't go to the police, right? And I'm going to point out that that kind of thing happens to all of the low status groups that we have traditionally marginalized. I'm talking about, up until just recently, LGBTQ populations. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about Native Americans. I'm talking about sex workers and undocumented immigrants. I'm talking about, you know, even anybody who looks Latino. You know, the assumption is that somehow they're illegal, and so mm-hmm. and so they're driven underground. And that's where people get exploited. You know, sex workers who have no access to services mm-hmm. because they're so stigmatized. And so, you know, as a society, we really need to look at these things, at the way we socially construct deviant populations, that it then becomes okay to deny rights and privileges to, that it then becomes okay to criminalize and to deny equal protection to. And it's not just polygamy from my perspective, but polygamists definitely feel this double bind.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And, you know, there's something I want to bring up is that as when we do start speaking up, here's the interesting thing. It's like we almost have to talk people into believing us. We've gone on countless interviews, just national TV, local TV, and it is really, it's interesting how difficult it is. And they just sometimes will just give you a weird look like, I don't know if I believe what you're saying. And one thing is, you know, we did a rally. We do some rallies and some other things sometimes just to create an education. So people, if people want to learn more, they can. It's out there, because before it was hard to find anything because nobody would speak up. So we did a rally, and my oldest son, who was 13 at the time, came up with his own speech for this rally. And he said, this is just a quote out of his speech. He said, you know, most people think that we as polygamous children are abused. You know, it's true. We are, but it's by our teachers and our peers, and they treat treat us so badly and exclude us. And they were. I could tell you the things that some of the teachers said directly to our children, and it is not right. And another thing is, you know, even going to the public schools, so we had several children with the same last name going to the same school, but from completely different families. And they would try to tell people, yeah, we're cousins. And even the teachers, nobody would believe them. They were just like, no, you guys all are in the same family and you all have the same dad. And it was completely ridiculous and they were completely different. But, you know, my point is, you speak up and they don't believe you anyway. So some people are like, why? Why speak up anyway? And so one interview in particular that I really remember is I was speaking to a gentleman who was interviewing us, and he was asking me, why do polygamists act so weird, you know, basically when you ask some questions? And I said, basically, we're afraid of what could happen and afraid of, you know, like even more of our freedoms being taken away. And I said, and you guys all think it's because we have something to hide. And he's nodded his head and he said, yeah, I do. And I said, we don't have anything to hide except for that we're afraid that we will be unjustly accused of something just for the fact that we are a polygamist. So we don't even dare say that much.
I find that really, really interesting because that plays into a lot of the work that I do. When I do cultural competence education so that I can, you know, help people access services when they need it. And one of the things that continually comes up is, well, you know, I try to be nice to them, you know, those people. I love it when we do that. But, you know, in Southern Utah, particularly, you know, the polygamists are visually identifiable, right? They stand out. And the question always gets brought up to me, well, why won't they make eye contact? So it means that they, you know, the women are subservient and they're not allowed to make eye contact with people. And I say, no, actually, when I looked like that, the reason I didn't make eye contact with you is because every time I did, the person that I made eye contact with thought that that was an invitation for them to come and tell me why I was wrong and bad. And I did not want to give anybody an opening. And so many of those activities, of course, get misinterpreted. And then it becomes the truth because nobody is contradicting that story.
Absolutely. And the simple thing of just going to the grocery store becomes a big deal.
Yeah. And I thought it was really interesting. You know, when House Bill 99 was being debated 2 years ago, now, you know, I left polygamy and I'm not a fan. I mean, I'm going to go on the record and say I'm not a fan of polygamy.
I support you.
Right? But I'm also not a fan of marriage because I think that the way we've socially constructed it is harmful to women right now. You know, it's not an egalitarian kind of structure. And we can argue about that all day long, but I'm not going to tell women, you don't get to get married because I don't agree with it. Right? I think people should be able to live how they want. But I do social services for people both fleeing polygamy and wanting to stay in polygamy. And I see the unintended harmful consequences of these strict laws that are designed to drive the population underground. And we're going to talk about that a little bit. But I really honestly believe that we really don't want to see polygamists. We want to not have them exist. We don't want to have them tarnish our reputation as a state. And so we're going to drive them underground with these harsh, harsh laws and make it easy for people to discriminate. And so I lobbied against House Bill 99 because it just has such horrible fallout and real human cost. But what was so interesting to me as while I, you know, I was up at the Capitol building and I was watching you guys talking about the impact on your life. And a lot of the legislators kind of just their eyes glazed over. It's kind of like, well, yeah, you're in here talking about it because you're a polygamist. And then if I would talk to them and I would start off by saying, I'm an escaped polygamist, all of a sudden I had all kinds of credibility. And they listened to me with intent. And I was suddenly, you know, my social status was much above yours because I rejected that lifestyle. And I see that over and over.
Isn't that interesting?
You know, you're just a second-class citizen because of your religion.
Yeah, but now you're brave.
Yeah, but now all of a sudden I've had education and all of a sudden I am not stupid and brainwashed. And it's so interesting to me because I'm the same person that I was, you know, 15 years ago when I left polygamy.
No, it really is interesting. You know, we'll interview with a lot of people and they oftentimes are, you know, surprised by our ability to be articulate and our ability to, you know, just our candor and things like that. And they say things, and they really say things like that. Well, you must must be the exception.
I got that all the time when I was a youth. It was hilarious. It's like, well, you're not like the normal polygamists because, you know, you're outspoken and you're articulate. And I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah. And we know so many people like us, you know, and so it was just, it was a little bit off-putting because how do you educate when that story is so strong and they'll just say, oh, it's not these guys. These guys aren't the problem, but it's all these other people, those people. And we've even had people ask us if you wouldn't be able to pick me out on the street, right? I'd just blend in with your everyday society, right? But people would say to us, are you going to go home and get back into your dress and put your hair back up in a bun when you get home? Like, they really thought that. And we have a big job ahead of us and, you know, we're up for the task.
Yeah. Well, and that goes back to how, you know, the extreme groups like the FLDS and what Warren just did really informs how everybody feels about all fundamentalists and all polygamists everywhere. You know, it's like,
yeah, they think that we all follow him.
And yesterday,
and we don't really admit it.
Yeah, even yesterday, I was giving a cultural competence training to a governmental department, a state department, and one of the people asked a question about, so I know you're FLDS, but what about these other FLDS groups? And I'm always saying they're not the same, and they're not FLDS. You know, that's an incorporated name.
Yes.
Let's define terms. And always I get questions about, so does everybody do this, or how do they do that? And I say, who?
Yeah.
Because again, we're talking about human beings, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if we ask, how does everybody in Salt Lake pay for their utilities? It would be an absolute insane question. But everybody, you know, they ask questions like that about all polygamists because that's how we get our minds around a group that we don't understand or that we fear. We're going to put them all in a basket and we're going to understand all of them based on one example.
Yes, it does make me just a little bit frustrated when I hear anyone, even if they're saying good things, when they say all polygamists do this or all polygamists don't do that. I mean, I've heard them say all polygamists homeschool their kids. I'm like, no, that's not true. And even if it's something they view as a good thing, I do not like that broad brush.
Well, it's just not true.
It stops what people are able to see as and be able to be educated. And in my family alone, you could ask me how I believe or feel about a certain topic and my sister wife would have her a completely different answer. So you can't even say our family does this, that, or the other. Now, there are some things where we represent and our family is very united on, but we are just our family and that's who we represent. We can't go represent people in other groups or even independent polygamists.
Yeah, and there's this tendency to believe that, you know, you hear about a crime that happened within the fundamentalist community, in any community, and those crimes get extrapolated to all of the communities. But that would never happen anywhere else. You know, it's like, I know of a rapist in St. George, and so everybody in St. George is rapist. It's preposterous. But people don't confront that when we're talking about this population.
Right. I see. It's hard for people to wrap their head around it, and that's why I will patiently spend my time educating.
Which is why we're here. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're going to get back and talk about the law again. This is my theory. I don't reside in anybody else's head and I can't explain their reasonings. But I really honestly believe that House Bill 99 was not passed to have a tool for law enforcement. I believe that they know that it wouldn't withstand scrutiny. And if they were to ever use it, that the higher courts would strike it down because of those egregious violations of the Bill of Rights. And so I believe that it was intended to have a chilling effect on the population. I believe it was intended to keep them firmly underground and firmly quiet so that, you know, we can continue to say, we are not that. The state of Utah is not that. And let me go on record as saying, I kind of get why there's this reticence to have polygamists come out and talk, Vicky, you know, go back underground. Because when I go back east, and when you go back east, listener, you get that. If someone finds out that you're from Utah, their first question is, are
you
polygamist?
How many wives do you have?
Right. And so there's this persistent rumor, which isn't true, right? And so you want to dispel that. And that's exactly what the fundamentalists want to do. They want to dispel those persistent, untrue narratives. You know, I'm going to point out that even since House Bill 99 was passed, there have been people who were arrested for those lower crimes. I'm talking about Lyle Jeffs and people who this law was not used on. They did not enhance his penalties using this law. And why? Because it won't withstand scrutiny.
Exactly. And, you know, we have brought that up to lawmakers and just said, okay, if it's going to, you know, just be there, but that you're not going to use it, why can't we, you know, codify that, actually, you know, make a statement that we're not going to prosecute just based on the fact that you are in a polygamous marriage. And interestingly enough, you know, there was that year span of time where they did decriminalize it. And we saw a lot of people come out of their shells, a lot of people from our culture. And I want to tell you, it's small things like this. I have my cousin's daughter who actually entered the reflections contest at school, would not have done that before, simply because polygamy was still against the law. I mean, there's all these little things like that, and you don't even realize the extent of how deeply it's reaching into some of their lives.
And again, I mean, I'm talking about the long-term human cost just on her opportunities. You know, how is that going to inform what she does going forward? And how is that going to impact her economic opportunities, whether or not she chooses to become a practicing polygamist in her future? What opportunities that she enjoyed right now is going to impact her economic opportunities, and it's going to impact the state's bottom line.
Absolutely.
You know, we've got to talk about all of the unintended harmful consequences.
Yeah. And what would we have them do? Just cut themselves off completely from their families, go change their name so that they can be a contributing member to society. That's almost what it feels like sometimes. And having people, you know, we asked for a lot of people to come up to the Capitol and, you know, put in their notes to the legislators and just say their piece and what they thought should happen. And it was really hard to get a lot of people from our culture to show up because of that fear, especially in a place of where there's going to be lawmakers or law enforcement in their minds. You know, that's just how it's viewed. And a lot of people did, but it took guts for them to do it. And it's something that a lot of people would just not even take a second thought about. Oh, I want to see this law changed. Okay, I'll go tell them how I feel. It's right? Just, we don't get to feel that way.
We don't get to enjoy your rights as citizens.
Right.
Because your very existence has been outlawed. And so what do you want to have happen with this law? Do you want polygamy to be legalized?
Well, I don't even know what all of that would look like. We're like one step at a time here, and we would like to just see it decriminalized so that we can come out and just educate and really become part of society. You know, who knows? You don't even know what we could add to your life. We have a lot of great things. In fact, we do, because our family is public and we have a lot of people, and they'll come into our home and interview us and they'll look at our children and they'll be like, wow, I could really learn something from you about how to raise children. I have 9 children. We probably know a few things because I'm not crazy.
And so I think I heard this, and I haven't been able to verify it yet, but my understanding is that other states like Arizona that has some pretty severe consequences for polygamy as well have quietly decriminalized it, in not by removing the law, but by actually removing the penalty. And so in Arizona, polygamy is still against the law, but it can't be prosecuted. And I find that really, really interesting, because then that really opens up a way for people to, you know, report other things. It's just like with Judge Waddups, when he was looking at the law, and he was the one that decriminalized, really just kind of negated this law against polygamy. And he pointed out, you know, and he said, why should it be illegal? And they said, because they abuse children. And he said, there's a law against that, right? Mm-hmm. Because they abuse their wives. Well, there's a law against that, you know, and all of the objections that were brought up to him, he pointed out that we can prosecute those things. What about polygamy itself should be illegal?
And yeah, should we prosecute everyone who cohabitates?
Right.
You know, just think about that. It's not going to happen. It couldn't.
Should we prosecute everyone who has a faith in Mormon fundamentalism? You know, it's like,
right,
you can't make laws that don't extend to other sectors of the population. And so even people who say, well, they brainwash their children, it's like, okay, well, let's outlaw all religion for that. You know, you don't get to selectively apply laws, and you don't get to selectively make laws that only apply to a certain population. So, you know, we've got to wind this up, but I just want to say, how can somebody get involved? You know, if somebody feels strongly about this, what's happening?
Well, there are a number of things that people can do, and one is really just educate yourself. Open your mind up to go, huh, maybe there is more to this story than I have been narrowly thinking about it. And even maybe if you know any that are, you know, in your neighborhood, maybe you could try to get to know them, reach out to them, see what their life has been like. We've been encouraging a lot of plural families to get out in their neighborhoods and just get to know people. Because I think once we are person to person, we see that that's what we all are, is human. And we can actually support one another in the lives that we choose and in just being good people. And I think we all want what's best for our state and our country. And I do particularly, of course, would like to see everyone have the rights to choose their path, as long as it doesn't harm other people. And I think that, you know, there are a lot of interviews. Our family wrote a book. It's called Love Times Three. It's on Amazon. You can look at that. It just kind of opens your minds up to something new. There are, what kinds of programs would there be? I mean, we oftentimes will be, if there's a legislative session, we'll be looking at that and we'll be going up to the Capitol to, you know, just to see who we can talk to that we can maybe give them a different perspective. And
right. So I want to point out too, Cherish Families offers cultural competence education. And so if you're someone, you know, we do it for private groups as well as public groups. If you're someone who works with the population and wants to know better how to interact with the population, go to our website, cherishfamilies.org, and request us to come out and talk to you. You know, we educate government agencies, we educate other nonprofits, we've educated, you know, hospital groups and doctors. And I think that honestly, I could seriously sum up that education with two words, and that literally is just be kind. You know, make the assumption that the person you're dealing with is actually a human being and not this animal that we've created polygamy to be. And so, did you have any final words?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And Cherish Families has done a lot to educate a lot of people and agencies. And I've even been a part of some of those trainings, and it really is eye-opening for all parties involved. And so I appreciate the work that they do. Absolutely.
Well, thank you for listening to us, and we will be back with more information on this topic. Thank you so much, Vicki.
Yes, thank you for having me.
The song you are listening to is titled Nostrand Avenue by Mormon artist Belle Jewell. You can support her and other amazing Mormon artists by downloading her album End of an Era by Belle Jewell or find her on Spotify.